You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. As well, you can hear these podcasts at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. There are two publishing houses, SteinerBooks.org in America and RudolfSteinerPress.com in England, which are the sole publishers of Steiner into English and have given me permission to do these recordings. Please consider patronizing them as well. This is a reading of Collected Works Volume 232 by Rudolf Steiner, entitled Mystery Knowledge and Mystery Centers, 14 Lectures, revised translation by Pauline Werle. This is Lecture 4, entitled The Relation of Human Beings to the Earth. A continuation of the themes we discussed last time will lead us today to things that will serve us as a preparation for the two following lectures. It brings us to study the connection of the human being, the whole human being, with our planet Earth. As I have often said, we are under a kind of illusion if we ascribe to ourselves as physical beings a full and individual existence separate from the Earth. As beings of soul and spirit, we are independent and individual, with regard to our physical bodies, and to some extent also in respect of our etheric bodies. We belong to the organic totality of the Earth. I will begin today by describing how this connection between human beings and Earth existence appears to supersensible vision. As a form of introduction, I will use a more narrative style today. Let us suppose that someone with imaginative consciousness were to go on a journey through the primeval Alps, where the rocks consist of quartz, of siliceous minerals, and similar formations. These primeval mountains are composed of the hardest rocks on Earth, but as well as being the hardest, these rocks, when they appear in their original form, have an inherent purity about them, a quality untouched by the commonplace things of Earth. We can well understand it when, in a beautiful essay, which has actually been read here, Goethe speaks of his experiences among these primeval mountains, of the solitude he felt as he sat there, and the impression made upon him by these granite rocks towering up from the earth. Goethe speaks of granite composed as it is of silica, mica, and feldspar, as the, quote, enduring sun of earth, close quote. When, with ordinary consciousness, a human being approaches these primeval mountains, he can, of course, admire them from outside. He is deeply impressed by their forms, by their wonderful structure, primitive as it is, but extraordinarily eloquent. However, if he approaches this hardest of rocks of the earth with imaginative consciousness, he penetrates beneath the surface of mineral nature, and is then able, with his thinking, to grow together, as it were, with the rock. He reaches in soul into the depths of the rock, and enters spiritually into a holy palace of the gods. The interior is revealed to imaginative vision as transparent, and the outer surface as the walls of this palace of the gods. At the same time, the knowledge comes to him that within this rock there is a reflection of the cosmos outside the earth. The world of stars is mirrored here before our soul. We ultimately get the impression that all quartz rocks are like eyes through which the earth can see into the cosmos. We are reminded of the many faceted eyes of insects, which divide into a number of parts whatever comes toward them from outside. We should, and indeed must, picture innumerable quartz and similar formations on the surface of the earth as being eyes, enabling the earth to mirror within it, and indeed inwardly to perceive, the cosmic environment. And gradually the knowledge dawns on us that every crystal formation present in the earth is a sense organ for perceiving the cosmos. The majesty of the earth's snow covering, but even more of the falling snowflakes, lies in the fact that in each single snowflake there is a reflection of a large part of the cosmos, so that with this crystallized water, reflections of parts of the starry heavens fall upon the earth. I need not remind you that the starry heavens are there by day as well as by night, only they cannot be seen by day because the sunlight is too strong. If ever you have an opportunity to go into a deep cellar with a high tower above it, open at the top, you can see the stars even in the daytime, because you are looking out of the darkness and the sunlight does not obtrude. There is, for instance, such a tower in Jena, through which the stars can be seen in the daytime. I mention this in passing to make it clear to you that this reflection of the stars in the snowflakes, and indeed at every crystal, is of course there in the daytime too. It is not a physical reflection, it is a spiritual reflection, and the impression a person can have of it must be communicated inwardly. But that is not all. This spiritual sense impression, if I may call it that, gives rise to a feeling in the soul that if you enter imaginatively into the crystal covering of the earth, you yourself are able to share in all the experiences coming from the cosmos to the earth through the crystals. You thereby extend your own being into the cosmos and feel yourself one with the cosmos. And most important of all, it now becomes a deep truth to someone possessed of imaginative vision that what we call our planet Earth, in every single part, has in the course of ages been born out of the cosmos. For here the kinship between the Earth and the cosmos appears vividly to the inner eye, EYE. Thus, by living our way into the millions of crystal eyes in the Earth, we are being prepared to feel and experience the inner kinship of the Earth with the cosmos. This experience, again, makes you realize how connected as a human being you are with the Earth. For this birth of the Earth out of the cosmos, and I shall describe this in far greater detail over the coming days, took place when human beings were still very primitive beings, not physical, but spiritual beings. And in their own being, humans shared in the processes undergone by the Earth after its birth out of the cosmos. In actual fact, the same inner connection once existed between the Earth and the neighboring cosmos as that between an unborn child and the body of its mother. Later, however, the child begins to become independent. Similarly, the Earth developed independently after having been more completely a part of the cosmos during the earliest part of the Saturn epoch. Human beings accompanied this process toward independence until they were finally able to say, "My finger is a finger only as long as it is part of my organism. The moment I have it amputated, it is no longer a finger and withers away." And if human beings, with regard to their physical part, can be thought of as separated by only a few miles from the conditions of the Earth organism, they would wither away like the amputated finger. Because they can move by themselves over the face of the Earth, people are under the illusion that as physical beings they have an existence of their own independent of the Earth, whereas a finger cannot run around by itself. If it could do so, it would be succumbing to the same delusion human beings succumb to regarding their own physical existence and the Earth. Higher knowledge makes clear to us this relationship of our physical nature to the Earth. So this is the first way in which imaginative consciousness helps us get to know the hardest component of the Earth's surface. A further way is possible by descending a little more deeply into the Earth, to the veins or lodes of metal ores, in fact to any metallic substance in the Earth's interior. Here you are penetrating beneath the surface of the Earth, but metals have a very special character, a character which deviates from that of any other earthly substance. Metals have a certain independence which can be experienced, and this experience is of very great significance for human beings. Even someone who reaches a certain level of imaginative vision still does not have a full grasp of things, when through experiencing quartz and other primeval rocks as the million eyes of the Earth, he expands his being into the cosmos. If, however, he penetrates farther into the interior of the Earth, the first impulses he receives can arise from the wonderful stimuli that can be had in a metal mind. Once you have the momentum, however, all that is necessary to be able to experience the nature of metallic substance without going down the shaft of a mind is spiritual vision. But the first feeling of the experience I am talking about can be acquired with particular intensity in metal minds themselves. It is no longer the case today, but it was still true a few decades ago that miners who are inwardly wedded to their work display something of this profound sense of the spiritual element in metals. For the metals not only see, in quotes, the surrounding cosmos, but they speak. Their speech is a spiritual kind, but speak they do and tell their story. And the language they speak is very similar to the impressions received from a language spoken in a different domain. You know, when we succeed in establishing an inner connection of soul with human beings who are in the stage of evolution between death and a new birth, we shall need a special language to communicate with them. What the spiritualists say is puerile, for the simple reason that the dead do not speak the language of earthly human beings. Spiritualists believe that the dead speak in such a way that their words can be written down, just as though a letter were being received from a contemporary living person. In most cases, the messages heard in seances sound high-flown and pompous, of course, but even on Earth, some of our living contemporaries sometimes write the same sort of thing. This is not how it is at all. The fact of the matter is that we have first to find the right approach to the language which the dead speak and which bears no resemblance whatever to any earthly language, although it does have a vocal, consonantal character. But the same language, and this can be apprehended only by spiritual hearing, is spoken by the metals in the interior of the earth. And the same language, by means of which we can approach the souls of the dead, living between death and a new birth, can also recount the memories of the earth, the experiences undergone by the earth in its course through the epochs of Saturn, Sun, and Moon, and so on. The metals can tell us of the past history of the earth. The destinies of our whole planetary system are to be learned from what Saturn has to communicate. It is of what the earth has undergone in the evolutionary process that the metals tell. The language in which the metals speak about the earth can also take two forms. In its usual form, it will reveal what the earth has undergone in the course of its evolution, beginning with Saturn. What you find about this evolution in my title, Occult Science and Outline, arose largely in this way, as I have often described, by direct spiritual perception of the process concerned. That, however, is a somewhat different way of learning about the earth's history than the one I have in mind just now. The metals, if I may put it this way, although naturally it sounds rather strange, the metals tell us more about the, in quotes, personal experiences of the earth as a specific entity in the cosmos. So if I wanted to lay particular emphasis on the stories told by the metals, stories learned by spiritual penetration into the interior of the earth, I should have to add many details of the Saturn, Sun, and Moon epochs, and so forth. A first example would, for instance, be that in the conditions on old Saturn described in my title, Occult Science, as consisting of differentiations of warmth, there appear gigantic and mighty warmth beings, which even during the Saturn epoch had reached a certain degree of density. Roughly speaking, I could say, if it were possible, which of course it is not, but if it were possible for an earthly human being to encounter these beings, he would notice them and even be able to touch them. Thus, about the middle of the Saturn epoch, these beings were not purely spiritual, but displayed a certain physical quality. If you had touched them, your fingers would have blistered. It would be wrong to assume that they had a temperature of millions of degrees, but their temperature was such that any contact would have caused blisters. Then we should have to pass to the Sun epoch and relate, as I did in Occult Science, how other beings appeared, manifesting wonderful transformations, metamorphoses. Seeing these beings in process of metamorphosis, we should get the impression that the metamorphoses described by classical authors, such as Ovid, have something to do, though of course not directly, with this experiencing of the communications of the metals. Ovid was certainly not himself capable of understanding the language of the metals directly, and what he describes in his title, Metamorphoses, does not fully convey the impression we get. But what he says is derived in a way from this source. And we can indicate the underlying process to a marked degree. You know, even Paracelsus, who lived at a much later time than the personality to whom I have just referred, did not go to college to learn the most important things he wanted to learn. I do not imply that he did not actually go to college, for as a matter of fact he did, and I have no objection whatever to such a course, but for knowledge of the greatest importance, he went where more significant information could be obtained. He went, for example, to men such as metal miners, and acquired a great deal of his knowledge this way. Anyone familiar with the technique of acquiring knowledge is aware of how extraordinarily illuminating the simple words of a peasant engaged in the business of sowing and reaping can be. You will say that he does not know what he is talking about. You do not need to bother about that as long as you understand what he tells you. Certainly it will be only very rarely that the speaker himself understands what he is saying. It is a matter of instinct. And even more fundamental knowledge can be acquired from creatures such as beetles, butterflies, and birds, who understand nothing at all of what they say to us. Pythagoras, on his travels, studied with great intensity what could be learned by listening to the speech of the metals in the mines of the Near East. And a great deal of what he learned made its way into what then became Greco-Roman culture. In a weakened form, it appears in a work such as Ovid's Metamorphoses. This is the one form of the speech of metals in the interior of the earth. The other form, and grotesque as this seems, it is true, is revealed when the speech of the metals becomes poetical and begins to produce cosmic poetry. Cosmic fantasy actually manifests in the language of the metals. And then this cosmic poetry tells of the close relationship existing between the metals and human beings. These most close of relationships do indeed exist. The crude relationships known to physiology involve only a few metals. It is known that iron plays an important role in human blood, but iron is really the only metal of this kind. A few others, potassium, calcium, sodium, and magnesium, also play a certain part. But a large number of metals, which are important for the structure and functioning of the earth, seem to crude observation to play no part in the human organism at all. But that is only apparently the case. If you penetrate into the earth and learn there to know the speech of the metals, you will also learn that the metals are truly not present only in the interior of the earth, but everywhere in its environment as well, although in exceedingly fine distribution, in a hyper-homeopathic solution, if I may so express it. In the crude material sense, we cannot have lead within us. In the finer, more ethereal sense, we cannot live without it. For what would become of us human beings if lead from the cosmos, from the atmosphere, did not have its effect upon us, if lead in an infinitely fine state of distribution did not penetrate with the rays of the sun through our eyes into our skin, if lead did not penetrate into us through the breathing process, and again, in an infinitely fine state, into the food we eat. In short, where would human beings be if lead did not work in them? Without lead, we would indeed have sense perceptions. We would be able to perceive colors and musical tones. But with every perception, we would become slightly faint, slightly out of our body. We would never be able to stand back from our perceptions and reflect in thoughts and mental concepts about what we had perceived. If we did not absorb any lead in the infinitely fine homeopathic potencies of which I spoke, into our nervous system and above all into our brain, we should be entirely given up to all our sense perceptions, as if they were something outside us. We should be unable to form any mental picture of our sense perceptions or retain any picture of them in our memory. It is the finely distributed lead in our brain that makes this possible. If a considerable quantity of lead is introduced into the human organism, the result is lead poisoning, a dreadful condition. But those who are aware of the facts can realize from this power of lead to poison that just because it has a disastrous effect, if introduced into the human organism in any considerable quantity, when it is administered in an extremely fine, hyper-homeopathic dilution, it can at any given moment bring about the dampening down of the life forces to the extent necessary to enable a human being to be a conscious being, and not to be perpetually in the grip of uncontrolled processes of growth, which cause faintness and loss of consciousness. For this is what happens if growth forces by themselves become overpowering. Human beings have definite relationships to all the metals, including those of which crude physiology says nothing. Knowledge of these relationships is the foundation for a true therapy. In quotes, inside information about the relationships of the metals to human beings can be given only by the poetic speech of the metals of the earth. So it may be said that whereas the ordinary speech of the metals gives information about the actual destiny of the earth, information about the therapeutic relationships of the metals to human beings is given by the metals when their speech becomes poetic. There is a remarkable link here. From the cosmic aspect, medicine is cosmic poetry. Just as altogether many mysteries of existence lie in the fact that what at one level is pathological or leads in that direction is at another level something of the loftiest, most perfect and beautiful nature. This is what emerges when inspired consciousness finds access to the metallic element in the earth. Now, we can relate in another way, too, to metals, and this comes about when metals are subjected to natural forces, for example, to fire. Just think of the remarkable formation of antimony ore. It is composed of single, spear-shaped structures, showing by this formation that it follows certain lines of force that are active in the cosmos. If antimony is subjected to a process of combustion, it becomes an antimony mirror, in quotes. When it is spread on glass, it develops a special power of reflection. It has other peculiarities, too. For example, it readily explodes if handled electrically and connected to a cathode. All these characteristics of antimony indicate how a metallic substance of this kind relates to the forces of the earth and the earth's environment. The same can be seen with all metals. This can be observed when they are exposed to fire and the temperature rises higher and higher and they pass, first of all, into the super-homeopathic condition, which I told you about. At these temperatures, they assume a quite different form. In regard to this, our modern physicists have only the roughest idea. They imagine that when lead melts, it becomes softer and softer, and so it does, to begin with. The lead gets softer and softer as the temperature rises, and as it gets hotter and hotter, it becomes more and more volatile, giving off lead fumes and so on. What the physicists do not know is that all the time something that does not reach beyond a certain temperature is being deposited, separated off. Lead in this finest, super-homeopathic state passes over continually into invisible life in general, and in this form it works upon human beings. Actually, it is always like this. In the earth itself there are metals of infinite kinds, but above the earth these metals are present everywhere in the finest possible state of distribution. They have vaporized. Down in the earth, the metals have their sharp contours and definite structures. At a still greater depth, they are, of course, in a molten condition. But in the environment of the earth, where they are in the finest possible state of distribution, they are continually radiating and actually radiate out into cosmic space. Now, in cosmic space, there is inner elasticity. However, the forces do not radiate in a limitless fashion, as the physicists imagine to be the case with light rays. But these forces ray out to a certain boundary and then return. As they ray back, the metal forces can be pictured as returning from all sides, from the periphery of the universe. And we observe these returning forces at work, where we witness one of the most wonderful, most beautiful of all sights in human life, a child in its early years of life, learning to walk, speak, and think. One of the most wonderful sights in the whole of earthly life is to see a child from the crawling stage, standing upright and orienting itself in space, coming to itself as a human being. The returning forces of the metals are working inwardly in the forces that give the child the power of orientation. As the child learns to raise itself from the horizontal position of crawling, it is permeated by the forces of the metals as they ray back. This is the force that actually raises the child into the upright position. If this connection is recognized, then at the same time you grasp another factor. It is that in the deeds and the essential nature of the human being living here on earth, you recognize the connection with his previous incarnation. The faculties for perceiving the workings of the metals in the cosmos and the karmic connection between the successive lives on earth are the same. The one recognition comes with the other, and neither is possible without the other. That is why I said, in an entirely different context, that in this power of orientation, in the power that enables the child to rise from crawling to standing and walking, in the faculties of learning to speak and to think, lie the fruits coming from earlier lives on earth. On that occasion, I said that anyone with an eye, EYE, for these things, perceives in the way children take their first steps, whether they tend to put their toes or heels down first, whether they bend their knees very much or not. In all this, a karmic disposition from an earlier incarnation can be perceived. It shows itself, first of all, in the gait. This is because, together with the faculty enabling the metal forces as they ray back to be perceived, comes the faculty to perceive the connection of the present life of a human being with his earlier lives. The assertion that anthroposophy is not open to proof is entirely unjustified. People who assert this are accustomed to bringing forward sense perception as proof, but that is tantamount to saying, quote, "Are you actually telling me that the earth moves freely in space? It is simply not possible. Either there must be something to support it, or it would fall." Close quote. In point of fact, it does not fall, because cosmic bodies mutually support one another. Only in the conditions prevailing on earth does everything need to be supported. So, it is only for truths recognized by the everyday consciousness that proofs can rightly be offered, if they are called for. Truths relating to the spirit are mutually confirmatory, but this must also be felt as an inner conviction. I told you some weeks ago that from the way a child or an adult walks, whether he raises his toes or his heel first, treads firmly or lightly, bends his knees a great deal or is more inclined to stand stiffly, these things show that the karma from his previous earthly life is coming to realization. Today I am showing you how the forces of the metals, as they ray back, enable us to recognize the connection between earthly lives. Here you see two mutually confirmatory truths. But it happens all the time that we hear a truth, then after some time we hear the same truth from a different angle, and perhaps we hear it a third time. In this way, the truths of anthroposophy confirm one another, just as in the cosmos the heavenly bodies uphold one another without needing outer support. It has to be like this when we rise from truths that are valid only for everyday consciousness to truths that are self-sustaining realities in the cosmos. And what anthroposophical knowledge comprises is indeed self-sustaining reality. You must hold together in your mind statements made at different times, statements that mutually support, attract, or also repel each other, revealing thereby the inner life of anthroposophical knowledge. Other forms of knowledge, customary today, live by virtue of the supports on which they are based. Anthroposophical knowledge is self-sustaining. The end of Lecture 4.